My name is Jeff Lerner, and I interview elite performers from a wide range of disciplines, entrepreneurs, athletes, celebrities, scientists, artists, and more. This is Unlock Your Potential.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Unlock Your Potential. Jeff Lerner, your host. Always so glad to be back with you, having amazing conversations with amazing human beings. Today, we are joined by, wait for it, another amazing human being to have an amazing conversation with. Her name is Melissa Urban. She is the co-founder and CEO of Whole30, which I was like, I didn't even remember the name. I was like, I have totally seen that chick on TV like multiple times. Oh yeah, Whole30. And then I started connecting all the dots. But like, you've probably seen her. She's been on all kind of shows. Good Morning America, Today Show. I think she was on Rachel Ray, I want to say. She's a 7-times New York Times best-selling author. I'm not even a 1-time New York Times best-selling author. So she's like 7 times. And has a really, really awesome mission, helping people establish healthy boundaries and successfully navigate habit change, which is a much more positive way of saying be less fat and like the way you look better, right? She sort of like spins it a lot more positive and health vibey, which I love. And she lives in Salt Lake and she has a son and a poodle, and we're glad she's here. Welcome, Melissa.
Thank you so much, Jeff. It's nice to be here.
So how bad did I offend you with my negative spin there? I was trying to pay you a compliment, but I felt like I fumbled it.
I know. As soon as you launched into the like, let's not be so fat, I definitely had a little look on my face. You know, I don't like to approach health or wellness from a diet culture mentality. We're not shaming people. We're certainly not making oversimplifications around nuanced and complex topics like body weight or health factors. But what I do at Whole30 is, as you said, you know, quite accurately, I help people change their health habits in relationship with food. And I've been doing that since 2009, and I'm incredibly passionate about it. And I'm excited to chat about that and so much more with you today.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this conversation. And honestly, it's really, really near and dear to my heart. Not in the sense of like having the right triglyceride balance, although that's also dear for our heart. But like, I just mean like it's a passionate topic for me. I lead a movement of entrepreneurial education platform. And one of the main staples of our ecosystem when you come into it is like, look, there is no such thing as compartmentalized success. You are kidding yourself if you think that you're going to go. And the way I'll actually explain to you how we explain it is we talk about your relationship with yourself is number one. And if you can't have a functional relationship with yourself, there's probably some cracks that are spilling over into your relationship with the 2 to 10 people you're closest to, what we would call your personal. So first we have your physical, then we have your personal. And then from there, we have your professional life, which is essentially your relationship with everyone else. It's your relationship with the market. It's your relationship with your workplace. It's your relationship with your customers, your relationship with the stakeholders, or your boss, or your underlings. It's all the other people. And so we live in this world that glorifies the ability to have a successful relationship with hundreds or thousands of people through the work that we do, but acts like there's not a grand hypocrisy in stacking that on a foundation of a dysfunctional relationship with the one who we should be the most connected to, which is ourselves. And so we say, hey, if you want to become an entrepreneur, it starts with you, right? Take care of one before you pretend that you have value to exchange with and you're going to take great care of thousands of customers and make millions of dollars. And so we frame it in an entrepreneurial context, but I feel like that model holds for everyone in this world. And that's why I'm so passionate about this. It's also why I'm so frustrated and probably sometimes so clumsy when I talk about it, because I don't have all the nuance that you do. And I sometimes get to the point where I just want to be like, dude, just stop eating. But it's not that simple.
Sometimes it's that simple, and also it's not that simple because there are so many systemic factors that we have to take into account when people have lived experiences that are not like ours. However, I do like the framework and the philosophy that it starts with you. That really is at the foundation of all of my work. As an entrepreneur, my motto has always been pay yourself first. In so many areas, make sure that you take care of your needs, your comfort, your mental health, your physical health, because if I don't have that, I'm of no use to anybody else. But even beyond that, I don't want to take care of myself just so I can be good for other people. I want to do it for the sake of taking good care of me. So that's at the foundation of my entrepreneur journey. In my work with Whole30, I really encourage people to take a step out of diet mentality and weight loss and this sort of system that we've all been indoctrinated into, and really identify the foods that work best for you in your unique body and context. And the Whole30 provides a framework with which to do so. And once you do that, you won't need to listen to anybody else's advice about what's healthy or not healthy. You will know what works best for you, and you'll have your own body's cues to pay attention to. And then in my boundaries work with this, which is really tangential and overlapping with Whole30, you know, I'm all about the idea of your needs and comfort have as much value and as much worth as everybody else's. And you have to get in touch with your own needs and your own feelings in order to set the healthy boundaries and limits with coworkers and bosses and family and really, you know, in other relationships, so that you can preserve your own time, energy, mental health, and capacity. So there's a ton of overlap in what we do. And I do hold that tenet central in basically everything that I do as well.
So first of all, I got to walk back. I'm not such a troglodyte that I think it's just like, dude, eat less. It's that simple. I, just a little bit of context. I have struggled mightily with food. Like I don't gamble. I don't watch things I shouldn't watch. I don't do drugs. But I will put down a buffet, right? Like that's my jam. That's my vice. That's my dopamine. My miswired dopamine circuit is around food, or maybe it's serotonin. I don't know. But anyway, so I was a fat kid. I was a bullied fat kid. I've yo-yoed about 50, 60 pound roller coaster up, roller coaster down multiple times in my life. And in the last 10 years, really, I would say 2000, it's whenever my mother-in-law died of pancreatic cancer, which is, you know, obviously the pancreas is the seat of the metabolism and insulin and blood sugar and all that. So like watching somebody die of pancreatic cancer was basically like, hey, that's what it looks like when your metabolic system fails. Stop doing that to yourself. Mm. And I've been in shape ever since. It was almost 10 years ago. Mm. So that's my journey. But so again, I know it's not as simple as just don't eat so much, but one thing that I learned in therapy, and I'm curious, I want to touch on this because you talk about healthy habits related to food, but also healthy boundaries in general. And one of the things that I was taught in therapy is that issues with food are always a substitute in our life for having some sort of sense, an inadequate sense of control. We're trying to wrestle for control of our environment or control of a situation or control of a trauma that we haven't been able to navigate out from under. And that food, for better or for worse, damn it, it is something I can control. And compounded sufficiently, it will actually create a barrier of protection between me and the rest of the world. And I'm curious how dogmatically true you believe that statement to be, and to some extent, how much that makes the work on boundaries and the work on food actually the same work.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a therapist, but I have done tons of therapy. So I can speak from my own experience. And I was a drug addict for 5 years, by the way. I have 23 years in recovery, but I know what it's like to be out of control with this substance and hate yourself for continuing to use this substance, and the shame and the isolation that it brings and the stress that creates and the cravings that brings on. And then, you know, it leads you right back to this behavior that you hate yourself for. I know that cycle because I was stuck in it for 5 years before I entered into recovery. I think food is so much more than food. And I talk about this often on the Whole30, in that food is also a way to show love and a way to bond with other people. And that can be an incredibly healthy experience. I think about some of my family traditions and some of my cultural traditions, and when people describe sharing food together or breaking, you know, bread as family, or some of the traditions that were handed down from their grandparents, I think that can be a really positive association in a way that food is so much more than food. But food can also be a proxy for, yes, control, but more than control. I used food as a way to numb and to distract and to self-soothe. People use food as reward or punishment, to relieve anxiety, to relieve loneliness, to relieve boredom.
food is a socially acceptable and even encouraged way of navigating discomfort. We're marketed all the time. Oh, did you break up with your boyfriend? Grab a pint of ice cream. Are you having a hard time as a parent? You better get your mommy juice and you know, get that bottle of wine. It is a socially acceptable, encouraged way of navigating discomfort, often in a way that doesn't serve us. And what I find with a lot of people coming to the Whole 30, it's often the only way people know to self-soothe and relieve anxiety and show themselves love and numb or comfort or navigate stress or discomfort. And I think the issue isn't that we use food as comfort. I think that absolutely has a place in our coping mechanisms. It's when food is the only thing we know how to do to show ourselves comfort or relieve anxiety. And in the process of performing those actions, we end up with a compounded layer of another issue. We're using food to navigate discomfort. And then on top of the discomfort now, we also have the negative effects of the foods or drinks that we are choosing to use, which just sort of adds to the stress or the discomfort that we're trying to evade in the first place.
Yeah, it's definitely a sticky wicket. It's the only drug that is impossible to quit cold turkey. I'm thinking if that's true. I think that's a true statement.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when I gave up drugs, the answer at the time was abstinence, 100% complete abstinence. I just stopped using drugs, but everybody eats.
Yeah.
So it's a lot harder to forge a healthy relationship with something if you are forced to continue to use that and try to create a healthy relationship kind of as you go. That's a lot harder.
How true do you think it is to say that actually there's what I'm saying is to some degree a based on a false premise, because so much food in the food supply now actually is more drug than food. Whether you're talking about a cookie or a potato chip or a mineral depleted, pesticide drenched piece of produce or whatever. And it actually, because I can only speak for myself, I basically treat simple carbs like they're a drug and I don't do drugs. And it's a lot easier that way. I don't have to be like, well, I need to have a healthy relationship with this cookie this time. I'm just like, don't eat cookies. They're bad for you. They're toxic. They're poison. Like sucrose is death. And it works great. And I don't really feel like I'm missing much because after 2 weeks of detox, I don't crave it anyways. So like, am I being too like dumb and binary here? Or can you just label certain foods as drugs and say, don't do drugs?
Oh boy. Okay. So I think that you have figured out a way to navigate food that works for you. And I think if that works for you, and it remains a healthy dialogue in your head, such that if you do stumble across a cookie that is so special and so delicious and so worth it that you decide to consume it, you don't then go on to have this negative self-talk and beat yourself up and tell yourself, you're such an idiot, you just ate poison. If you can navigate that by saying, I don't eat cookies most of the time because they don't make me feel my best, but if on occasion, you know, if my mom makes homemade chocolate chip cookies and I have one, I'm going to be totally okay with that. I think that's a perfectly, you know, fine place to come to on your own. And I think everyone's self-talk around these foods and our relationship with food is going to look different. I don't like to assign morality to food. I don't like to say that foods are good or bad. There are no universal.
So you think labeling something as poison is a moral statement?
I think
a chemistry statement?
Well, I think it, first of all, chemically, everything is a chemical. So I find it, there's a little bit of...
Well, I mean, I should say it's a biochemistry statement. It's a description of how the chemistry happens inside the human body.
Yeah, but I mean, like...
I mean, sugar is toxic. Like, simple table sugar is toxic, period, the end, every time. It's degrees of toxicity based on quantity. But like, can... You know, and I'm not here to like, steel man the other side. I'm more just saying like, how, you know, simple... bite-sized takeaways, no pun intended, for listeners, like, oh, I can define certain foods not as food but poison and therefore avoid them the way I would avoid other poisons, even though certain poisons in small quantities might not be lethal. Is that potentially a healthy perspective or is Jeff cray-cray?
I would not ever recommend that strategy. because I do think, and I will speak specifically to the way diet culture has infiltrated women's mindsets in particular. Certainly everyone is kind of swimming in diet culture and the messaging that it brings, that food, some foods are good, some foods are bad, that you are good when you eat good foods and bad when you eat bad foods. And this is reflected in all kinds of language that I grew up with, right? My aunts would say something like, oh, you're being so good by, you know, saying no to dessert, or I'm going to be naughty and have a second piece of pie. And we absorb that growing up, and we think that certain foods are good or bad, and we are good or bad when we eat them. And I don't think that that serves most people. If it serves you, I will allow you to define that for yourself. That's never how I would describe food. I would say that context matters. And in the context of my 10-mile hike in the Wasatch the other day, sugar was fantastic. It tasted great. It kept me energized. My body utilized it well, and that was a fantastic way for me to eat sugar. Or the Cadbury cream egg that my mom sends me every year at Easter because it reminds me of home and my Easter basket. That is a very healthy food for me, despite the fact that if you look at the ingredient label, you might objectively say, wow, there's a lot of artificial ingredients in there. So I think it's overly simplistic to call any food toxic or poisonous. I think context matters tremendously. And I do work really hard to change the language and the mindset and the associations we have around food such that we don't assign morality to either food or ourselves when we eat it. I don't think that's helpful for most people.
Yeah, I will say I completely agree with the morality. Again, maybe I'm just sort of like overly empirical. I actually like knowing what simple, like what table sugar does in my body. I like knowing what it does to my pancreas. I like seeing a chart of what it does to my brain and my blood sugar and going, oh yeah, I think about that much the same way I would think about, like, I don't think that, you know, arsenic is immoral. I just happen to think it's poisonous. So anyway, we don't need to camp on this too much. I'm sort of like probing at this because I do think sometimes people, there's a level, I almost feel like there, and you can totally tell me I'm being an asshole in saying this. I sometimes think we take ourselves so seriously that we just indulge all the emotional seriousness that we have around food and the memories and the hippocampus and the emotional memories that it brings up for us and the limbic brain and the subconscious associations. And it's like turns into this big mush ball of feelings when, like, what's worked for me is to just sort of like abstractly and empirically go like, this is good for me, this isn't. And I'm going to like train myself over time to prefer things that are good for me over things that aren't. And like, that doesn't have anything to do with my first divorce or the day my dad didn't come home late or something, like came home late or something. Like, you know what I mean? Like, give ourselves permission to just not be so freaking complex all the time.
I get it. You know, there are people like you or I, because I can do this too, where if I say to myself that I have discovered that this food isn't serving me, I'm just not going to eat it anymore. And I don't. And it's not hard. And I don't agonize over it and I don't crave it. It's just once I decide to do something, it's very black or white. I'm on or off and I can make that decision. It took me a very long time to realize that most people aren't like me and they have a different relationship with internal and external expectations. And they have a different background with food and, you know, the systems that we live in and trauma and, you know, privilege and all of that really gets wrapped up. And where I'm always very careful is not to say, well, this works for me, so I don't understand why it doesn't work for you. And I have 14 years of, you know, Whole30 experience that has helped me kind of guide and shape that philosophy. I would never take away the fact that this works awesome for you. And there are probably some people listening that are going to go, oh yeah, what Jeff said makes a ton of sense. I could do that too. I want to offer alternatives for the people that listen to you and go, that does not, no, that it's like way more complex for me than that. I want to acknowledge that is true for those people and come up with other language or philosophies that are going to work equally well for them, just via a different path.
Do you think that, I mean this sincerely, this question, it doesn't come preloaded with an expected answer, to be clear. Do you think that, you know, sort of the the mindset that I'm describing, which you say you and I share, which I very much believe, because I can look at your life and talking to you and knowing what you've done and knowing that you wrote 7 best-selling books, not just 1, 7, and you've done this and you've sustained it over a period of years, and you've also been to the bottom with addiction and been to the top with success. And like, forgive me for thinking I can size a person up, but like, you would be consistent with the guest list of this show, which is highly successful people that are outliers in their fields, whether it's entrepreneurial, athletic, performance-based, artistic, whatever, and who actually do tend to demonstrate or display the adage in their life that how you do one thing is how you do everything. And that the same way you have the discipline and the consistency to say, hey, you know what? Eating that doesn't serve me, so I'm just not going to eat it again, and I'm not going to lose a lot of sleep over it. That's the same muscle that says, hey, waking up early and having a disciplined, consistent morning routine will serve me and will get me where I want to go. So I'm going to do that every day. And it's the same muscle that probably says, okay, I'm going to develop the emotional resilience or maturity or communication cadence or whatnot, that when my significant other or my kids or, I don't know your family situation, but when they trigger me, instead of doing the emotionally satisfying response of like freaking out and yelling and throwing a tantrum, instead I'm going to have the adult response and navigate it this way, because that's going to get me where I want to go. And I'm sure that type of discipline shows up in all these different areas of your life, where it's not just how to be lean or healthy, it's actually how to be successful, is to have that discipline to say, like, I'm going to consistently commit to the right decisions and build the discipline muscle to maintain that over long sustained periods of time, because that's what it takes to do anything meaningful. So with that as my setup, my question is, do you feel like your strategy of helping people have, let's call it, a more nuanced way of working through their relationship with food is just meant to get them to the place where what we're talking about can start to become a muscle they can build and be a possibility? Or is it actually a solution in the sense that you don't graduate past it? It's you're going to allow it to always be that complex and messy, and to have this more nuanced way of dealing with it, because there's not this idea that on the other side of it, you need to get to the place where you're just a disciplined and consistent person that doesn't have to struggle so hard.
I mean, I think it is more of the latter, in that I am not trying to shove round pegs into square holes. I have friends who are super successful in every single area of their life, and they are not disciplined the same way that I am. They don't develop the same consistency that I do. They have vastly different routines and vastly different schedules, and we're very, very different, but they still are incredibly successful and very happy with their life, and I would consider them very healthy. So I'm not trying to get people to a place where they are kind of where I've arrived at because of my personality, because of my upbringing, because of, and this is like another layer of this conversation, but because of the many privileges that I currently have as I exist in this world, I'm not trying to get people to the place where they operate like I do. What I am trying to do is empower them to prioritize themselves and put themselves first, identify their own needs and feelings, because so often they come to me in tune with what everyone else needs and wants for and expects from them, but with no insight whatsoever as to what they want or what they need or how they feel. And then to take that and build small wins, if needed at the beginning, to make a promise to themselves and keep it. No matter how small that is, no matter what that looks like, they don't have to get up every morning at 5:30 and work out for 60 minutes like I do. They don't have to have this like super strict morning routine that I've cultivated. It doesn't have to look like that, but I want to get them to the place where they are in touch with their own needs and feelings, where they're comfortable saying, I am worthy of making this promise to myself and keeping it, and then taking whatever step it is to move them closer to whatever their definition of health looks like. And that might be food, it might be movement, it might be meditation, it might be therapy, it might be professionally, or there are so many different avenues that people can take, but I want to meet people where they are, and I want to help them get to where they need to get to, and I don't need to turn them into another version of me in order to do that, I don't think.
Okay, so I'm loving this conversation, by the way. This is like so fun. I have two questions that I feel like this is the right moment for us to kind of take a step back.
Yeah.
And ask two things. One is, with whatever brevity or not that you choose, what's the winding road that got you to doing this? And then also, I want to give you ample space to unpack what this is and really articulate the whole 30 approach.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it really did start when I was in recovery for the second time for my drug addiction. I was not, people ask me like, oh, you must have always been so healthy or maybe you played sports. No, I was a, book nerd. I preferred reading to people. I was very smart. I was like the pleasure to have in class. Things went sideways when I was a teenager and I turned to drugs as a means of coping. And I used for 5 years. I went to recovery. I was in recovery for a year. I relapsed. And the second time around, I realized I had to change everything about my life in order to make this recovery stick. And that's when I decided that I was going to be a healthy person with healthy habits. And I started going to the gym in the morning. I made new like-minded friends at the gym who ran, and I started running with this new group of girls who didn't know my past and didn't know that I was new to recovery. I got a new job. I moved. I started paying attention to what I ate. I really embraced this full-on life change. And that's where really health and fitness came in. And as a result of that kind of pursuit in 2009, so 9 years into recovery, I had been highly involved with CrossFit and writing for the CrossFit Journal and blogging about my, workouts and philosophy and life. I had always kind of enjoyed writing. I did this two-person self-experiment designed in the kind of intention of, well, I wonder if kind of cleaning up my diet, just that last 20%, if it would help my recovery and my performance in the gym. And what I discovered at the end of those 30 days was that my relationship with food was profoundly unhealthy and that I was using food the way I used to use drugs. And I never realized it because nobody ever called me out for it and because it was socially acceptable. And because I had food, I never learned other coping mechanisms to navigate stress. I went to therapy, but I didn't know what else to do sitting alone at home at 8 o'clock at night, feeling really anxious or lonely or scared. And my first Whole 30 profoundly changed not only my health and habits, but my relationship with food in a permanent way. And I thought I should write about this and see if anyone else is interested. And that was really the birth of the Whole 30 program, a 30-day self-experiment designed to help people identify food sensitivities, create new healthy habits, and reestablish a healthy relationship with food. And that's been my full-time job for the last 14 years. I never wanted to own my own business. I never dreamed of becoming an entrepreneur, but I was so passionate about watching people go through these life-changing transformations with this 30-day program that I jumped ship on my full-time insurance job and took Whole 30 full-time in 2010, and I've been doing it ever since.
Yeah, I'll bet the insurance companies just hate you. You're just lowering premiums left and right, getting people in shape.
I wish we could collaborate, right? Call me.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so describe to me in as much detail as you choose. Obviously, don't give away the whole program, right? Or maybe it doesn't. Maybe it's information doesn't produce transformation and it wouldn't matter what you told or gave away. But like, obviously, there's a lot more in the 30 days than just like food journaling. I'm picking that up. Like, can you tell me what's the difference between this and like going on a diet for 30 days?
Yeah. So the Whole 30 is free, by the way. The entire program is free. It has always been free. It will always be free. You can go to our website, download the rules and resources and recipes and all the support you need, and you don't have to buy anything but your food if you want to do it that way. That's really important for us for accessibility. Essentially, the Whole 30 is based on the framework of an elimination diet, which is still considered the gold standard for identifying food sensitivities. So for 30 days, you'll eliminate foods that are commonly problematic to varying degrees across a broad range of people. You're going to pull those foods out of your diet for 30 straight days and see how the elimination of those foods impacts your cravings, your digestion, your blood sugar regulation and metabolism, your, inflammation and immune system. So anything from acne, allergies, migraines, anxiety, chronic pain, or joint pain and swelling, any number of symptoms can be impacted by the food that you're eating, even the stuff that you might consider healthy, if you do in fact have a food sensitivity. So think of it like a scientific experiment. You pull it out for 30 days, see what happens. At the end of those 30 days, you'll reintroduce those foods carefully and systematically, one at a time, like a scientific experiment, and you compare your results. So if you give up dairy for 30 days and all of a sudden you notice your seasonal allergies are so much better and you're less congested and your eyes aren't running and you're less wheezy, and then you reintroduce dairy and all those symptoms come back, that gives you valuable insight about the way that food works in your unique body. And you can then take that information to create the ideal, sustainable, delicious, long-term diet for you based on what you know about yourself. That's the foundation of the Whole30.
Okay, so I'm looking at the website. That sounds awesome, by the way. I'm so glad you're doing that for some. How many people have been through this program? It's like gazillions, right?
I mean, it's hard to track, but millions, absolutely, based on, you know, book sales and website traffic, yeah.
By the way, how does that feel to have literally impacted millions? Like, you could get hit by a bus tomorrow and be like, well, I impacted millions of people.
Yeah. It feels awesome. My favorite part of the job is listening to people tell me about their Whole30 stories. I've heard some amazing, miraculous stories. I hear them every single day in comments and DMs and emails. And yeah, it feels great. I'm so excited that what we share is having such a positive impact on so many people's lives. It's awesome.
Yeah. So looking at the website and having read some of the testimonials and stuff, it seems like, I mean, this is what I'll say, regardless of the philosophy, you know, the proof's in the pudding, so to speak, right? Like, you have stories of people talking about not just how it changed their relationship with food or with their body, but I mean, like, it's like I saw multiple stories of people talking about it. It's like their whole life was transformed. They talk about gateway drugs. It almost seems like this is an inversion of that. It's like a gateway solution, like solve your issue with food and a lot of other stuff gets cleaned up in life too.
Hey there, sorry to interrupt the show, but I just have a quick favor to ask. So we recently broke into the top 100 podcasts in the entrepreneurship category. We've been hovering around 75 and we're really trying to push up into like the top 20 and grow the impact of the show. So if you enjoy what we do here and you're a supporter, the biggest thing you could do to help would be to leave us a positive review. Whatever platform you're listening on, you should be able to leave a quick review. Let the world know what you like about the show. Thank you so much for your time and let's get back to it.
Yes, I say all the time that the way we show up with food is the way we show up everywhere. And our relationship with food is so foundational in that if we feel out of control with food, if we feel as though we have these uncontrollable cravings and we're, you know, there's negative self-talk with the way that we're using food to self-soothe or relieve anxiety or relieve discomfort, that's going to show up in all of our other relationships. And what I find is that when people take on a Whole30, they make that promise to themselves. Again, it's about food, but it's about so much more than food. And the benefits that you get from the program will spill over into every single area of your life. And I've had people who have made profound life changes, like quit jobs, gone back to school, dumped a loser boyfriend, finally moved to that city they wanted to move to. All of these different kind of things that come from this sense of self-confidence and self-efficacy that the program brings you, not to mention rockin' energy, better sleep, smoother digestion, fewer aches and pains. All of those physical things only aid in the sense of self-confidence and self-efficacy. But yeah, the program seems to have this really amazing synergy where the sum of the parts equals so much more than the whole.
So let's go back to that first 30 days. You know, for context, a lot of this is the nature of the podcast and the guests and the conversations. And then some of it is the nature of my audience that feeds the podcast, which is all that to say, a lot of people that are either starting a new thing in their life or are on the precipice of, or at least in consideration of like starting a new thing, whether it's a new business or a lot of times it's a new business or a new career, upskilling to, you know, I'm Atra, my sweatshirt and my company are like, if you don't like your job and you want to learn the new skills that create a bunch of different options in the modern economy, we teach those to you along with the Life Operating System to help you integrate them and change your life and take it in any direction you want. So my audience is so often is people right on the cusp of X, Y, or Z, right, in their life. And so I like to, in my conversations, go back to your cusp moment, right? When you were right there maybe it was when you had just written, you had just done your first 30 days, or maybe it was when you were blogging about it, or maybe it was when you were considering it or whatever. But when was that kind of inception moment when you're like, okay, this could be a thing. This could be my thing. This could be a life-defining thing. And most importantly, damn it, I'm going to do this. I'm going to bet on this, however crazy the rest of the world might tell me I am.
Yeah, I love it. My mom definitely thought I was crazy. She was so mad that I quit a job that had really good insurance. She was like so mad about that, so worried about me. You know, I had been doing this 9-to-5 insurance job while running Whole30 on the side, like nights and weekends, for a year. And my insurance job was not, I managed a team of about 20 people in 3 different offices. I ran a team of business analysts and operations assistants. And, you know, I'd worked my way up in the company and it was a very well-paying job and I really liked it, but I was doing that full-time. I was writing blog posts and articles and resources and traveling on the weekends to go do speaking events about Whole30, and nothing was getting done well. You know, I was kind of like burning the candle on both ends. And when I and my co-founder had this kind of April, you know, Whole30 self-experiment, we both got really dramatic, just life-changing results. I was like, this is interesting. When I wrote about it on my little CrossFit training blog a couple months later, and 100 people said, yeah, we would try it. And I guided and led 100 people through it. And at the end of those 30 days, 100 people reported just remarkably similar, equally life-changing results. That was the moment where I was like, oh, we have something here. This is persuasive. This is not just an N of 2. This is now 100 people who say, yeah, we had these results. And you know, I just kind of decided I needed to either put my foot in one camp or the other. And my insurance job just wasn't anywhere near as fulfilling as the potential of this. And I was well paid and I had savings and I didn't have a lot of debt. And I thought, you know what, I'm just going to go for it. And like, if it doesn't work, I'll just go get another job. You know, that's fine. But that was the moment where I said, you know, I really want to just invest everything I have into this Whole30 thing and like see if I can make it do something for the impact, really. I was really very interested in, again, how much impact we could have with this.
Were you married and or with children at the time?
No, I wasn't married and I didn't have kids, which makes a huge difference, right? I was, you know, single and like I said, I didn't have a lot of debt. Like I had a lot going for me in this situation.
Well, and you're only like 27 now. So in 2009, you're like just a child, right?
I was just barely a teen. Bless you. Yes.
Exactly. Exactly. No, that's obviously such a huge variable, you know, for so many people listening that are really, really considering that thing, whatever it is. But frankly, even if you had significant others or dependents, I mean, you had something that was fairly well validated. I mean, if you produce 100 out of 100 positive results, that's a pretty good sample. So I guess all that to say, I mean, I love that you found a way to validate what you were trying to do without having to, you know, burn all your boats just to try it, right? And I think that so often on the internet-based entrepreneurship conversation likes to glorify this, you know, jump off the cliff and try to build the plane on the way down. And it's like, well, it doesn't have, I mean, I guess if that's your only option, but have you explored every other slightly more sustainable and risk mitigating possibility than that? Maybe you should.
Yeah. I mean, looking back, I did not know what I was doing. I had no plan. I had no strategy for a very long time. And I definitely was building the bus, you know, while we were driving it. But I did have enough factors lined up that I knew I had sort of a cushion or a safety net and I could afford to like take some time to figure it out. And that does make a big difference.
So I'm curious, looking back, you know, I have a pretty strong belief that I think every human on earth, and this is where maybe earlier in the conversation, if it felt at all like we were not totally aligned, it's because I was kind of trying to feel you out and see where you land and sort of in line with what I'm about to say, which is like, I actually think it's not a version of Melissa. It's not a version of Jeff. It's a version of whoever, but there is a badass version of that person locked up inside every version of that person, right? For me too, for you, as badass as you are, there's 100 times more badass version of Melissa waiting to be unlocked. That's ditto for me.
Yeah.
And it's ditto for everyone else. And that's why I have a show called Unlock Your Potential. That's why I wrote a book called Unlock Your Potential. That's why I created a platform to help people unlock their potential and so forth, right? I'm really into this unlocking of potential. And so you know, what I challenge when I come across it is the idea of people who think that sort of a smaller life is what they were optimized for. Like, hey, you know, that Melissa lady, she's meant to be wildly successful and live out loud and disruptive and influence all these millions of people. But me, I'm just more of like the take care of my kids and like don't make waves type of person. I don't think that's a type of person. I think that's just a decision somebody made at some point because somebody robbed them of some sense of possibility. And so I guess all that to say, what I try to orient people toward is that the clues to your amazing, amplified, created purpose, the reason you're on this earth, the reason you're not just one of 8 billion, you're truly one of one, the only one, those clues have been scattered throughout your whole life, like Hansel's breadcrumb trail, right? And so I'm curious, can you look back at your life and see, I was always meant to do this? And if so, what were the clues?
No, I cannot look back and go, oh, I was always meant to do this. No.
You really don't think so?
No, I mean—
You don't think we could do an exercise to find the clues that maybe you just haven't seen?
I don't know. Like I said, never, I'm one of the incredibly fortunate people who gets to live my passion. Not everyone gets to work a job that is their passion. Lots of people just work a 9-to-5. They've got to put food on the table. They've got to supply, you know, for their family. And by the way, I don't actually believe that someone can't be their most badass version of themselves while being super content, staying at home with their kids and just building a really nice life for them. I think that is an equally valid life choice, but I don't think I was meant to do this. I think that I had a series of events that were a combination of hard work and interest and talent and privilege and luck that led me to this place. But I think, you know, I don't know. I it'd be hard for me to look back and go, oh yeah, this thing was like always leading or guiding me to this. I don't know. I never thought about it like that. I feel like there's something about that that feels weird to me, but I'm not sure why.
Does it feel? Yeah. Okay. So this is great. Cause I mean, like, you know, we don't all have to just agree. That's boring. I'd rather find the most important thing, period. And then whatever we think or feel about it, let's dialogue, let's get there. That makes for interesting conversations. So, cause again, I'm like steadfast in this. And to be clear, I'm not saying if somebody's, you know, doing a great job of raising their children and, you know, creating an amazing domestic environment for their children, that embodies some sort of failure. That's not at all what I'm saying. I'm saying that within that construct, I believe there is some sort of ripple effect, teleological purpose for which you are designed on this earth. Otherwise, we are just biology. We are just Darwinism. We are just DNA trying not to die longer than our host. And it's like, yep. No, damn it. There's something spiritual. There's something metaphysical. There's something created and intentional. Otherwise, frankly, this is all pretty boring and I should just go do what feels good.
Yeah.
Why the hell do I ever sacrifice anything if there's not intention and purpose behind it?
Mm-hmm.
And so given that, I feel like it's incumbent on every life to figure out what that is. And I don't think that the universe or God or karma or whatever is such a prankster that it's like, oh, you have a created purpose and I shall not reveal to you any clues as to what it is. Like, the clues have to be there.
Mm. I mean, if you're going to go like Buddhist, Byron Katie philosophy, I know that I am meant to do exactly what I'm doing right now because I'm doing it. Hard stop, right? Like, I am meant to do what I'm doing because it's happening right now. And people often ask me about, you know, regret. Do you have regrets? Do you wish that you hadn't been a drug addict? Or if you could go back and you know, take back the sexual abuse that happened as a teen, would you? And of course, being in a place right now where I love what I'm doing and I love my work and I love the growth that I've been able to accomplish personally and professionally, of course, I wouldn't change any of that. So if you talk about crumbs, you know, if the assault hadn't happened, I wouldn't have turned to drugs. I would have had no reason to whatsoever. And if the drugs didn't happen, I wouldn't have had that you know, thing to overcome in that moment of crisis, and maybe not the impetus to get so heavily into fitness and health and nutrition. And that might not have spurned like the you know, spurred the path that I'm on right now. So maybe you could look at those as crumbs. I don't know. I'm just not one of those people that thinks about the meaning of life. And I'm not one of those people who feels like I need to leave some kind of legacy. I love that I am. It's cool. And earlier in the show, you were like, if you died tomorrow, you'd be like, wow, I was able to help a million people. And that's cool. But like, that doesn't, I don't know. There's nothing about that that really like jazzes me or excites me.
So in Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, which is one of my foundational books for my life, which, as you might suspect from my position I'm taking about man having, you know, intrinsic meaning. There's a great quote where he says something to the effect of success, like happiness, must ensue. It cannot be pursued.
Mm.
And that when you pursue it, it runs away. I'm totally butchering it.
I get it.
And then when you're surprised to find it, you should know that it exists precisely because you weren't going after it.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that very much. And that's why I talk about when we figure out, you know, people are, they're trying to achieve success or attain or obtain success. And my position is no. That will ensue if you simply get properly oriented towards your purpose. Like when you're, and even the term fulfillment, I think you use the word fulfilled, like that comes from the old English word fulfillon, which is the fulfillment of prophecy. It's essentially the realization of your destiny produces the sensation of fulfillment. That's why we use the word fulfillment to mean fulfillment. And so I'm always trying to orient people toward their purpose and look backward for the clues and look forward then for the possibilities of how to take those clues and operationalize them into a mission. And what I'm going to share with you a totally unscientific, possibly offensive observation that my wife and I have had together. We have a weird interest in the show My 600-Pound Life, partly because I'm from Houston and I grew up pretty close to Dr. Nazarden's office and I like seeing him drive around my old neighborhood, but also because I just find the human story so tragicomic and bizarre and just like mind-blowing sometimes. It's like slow suicide by food, basically. Unless, you know, the interventions work. Like, it's really gripping. But one of the things that my wife and I remarked after having gone through a few seasons of that is like, damn, there is a lot of sexual abuse underneath these stories. Like, how many of these people, I mean, does it sort of naturally appear that what they're actually trying to do is create a moat between themselves and the rest of the world that's 24 inches of flesh, literally, like to keep people away because they've been violated. And so my, again, totally unscientific, I don't even know if I dare call it a conclusion, but suspicion based on watching many episodes of that show is that there's a lot of sexual abuse underneath food issues, particularly I would imagine women's food issues.
Yeah.
And so whether that's true or not, probably doesn't change what I'm about to say, but that is to say, if you've experienced sexual abuse and you've experienced addiction and now you help people renegotiate their relationships with food, then I would suggest that in a very, very real way, you are taking back those issues, not just for yourself, but potentially for millions of people.
Yes. The reason I started talking about my addiction in the first place was one, because I've always been thin-bodied. And so when I would get up in front of a group of people talking about the Whole 30 and talking about feeling out of control with food and uncontrollable cravings and an unhealthy relationship with food, people would literally stop me and say, "What do you know about this?" And so I started to talk about my addiction first as a means of saying, I understand what it's like to feel out of control and to hate yourself for it. But the more I talked about it, the more I was able to release the shame that I still carried around it. And it's the same with talking about my trauma and sexual abuse, my divorce, I talk about a lot on Instagram. I talked about that one time I got syphilis a couple years ago or chlamydia, I think it was. The more I talk about these things, the less shame I carry around them and the more I give other people permission to do the same. And honestly, if we're going to talk about my purpose, I think that's my purpose. It is giving other people permission to find their voice and reclaim their truth. That's really at the heart of, I think, what I do and what my purpose is.
So I love that. And honestly, damn it, if that's not my purpose too, right?
Yeah.
I was born with a genetic disorder. I was bullied horribly. I was mistreated by the school system and by students that were sanctioned within the school system. I dropped out of high school. I had blah, 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 my list and your list. We all have a list, right?
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, I figured out, you actually said it earlier when you were talking about internal versus external control systems, that ultimately it's about reclaiming my internal locus of control and finding my voice. That was Stephen Covey's eighth habit, is find your voice and inspire others to find theirs. Mm-hmm. And I actually think that if you get deep, and again, this is based on like Entra, my platform, is not like, I mean, I was retired when I started it. I didn't like need another business or another big project. It was my grand social experiment, basically to use entrepreneurship as a carrot, i.e. make more money, quit your job, as a carrot to say, come discover what it's like to live a life of alignment and purpose. And by the way, you can marry that with some professional skills and actually create like you've done, operationalize it into a business, a mission-driven business that can pay your bills. It can fuel your life and fill your cup, so to speak, right? So that's, you know, for context. But because I do that and I've done that and I have thousands and thousands of data points of people that have been, you know, like yourself, people that have made that transformation, what I would say is a common theme in my experience is exactly what you just said, that if you peel away the enough layers of your individual purpose and the way that it's unique to you underneath it, everyone's purpose, this is a grand statement, damn it, if it doesn't seem like it's all the same. Mm-hmm. To find your voice, mm-hmm. to become fully self-expressed, to live your truth, and to lead others. You know, Ayn Rand said, civilization is the process of setting man free from men.
Mm.
To lead others away from the collective into the light of individual experience. And that's actually everybody's purpose. I think that's why we're on this earth. I think that's why this whole thing exists. And I think we're just finding different ways to do it.
This is why when you asked me about the breadcrumbs and my purpose on the heels of talking about Whole30, I said it felt weird and I didn't know why. It's because Whole30 is not my purpose. It is the vehicle for my purpose, which is to help people reconnect to themselves and their body, find their voice, and remember their power. That's it. So that's why it felt weird. And that's why it didn't feel right. And that's why I couldn't find breadcrumbs. But if we're talking about this as my purpose, every single experience I've had has given me an opportunity to say, I'm going to reclaim this as part of me. I am not going to distance myself from this piece of myself, from addict Melissa, from abused Melissa, from, I'm going to reclaim her and I'm going to give power to her and I'm going to talk about her and I'm going to lift her up and I'm going to encourage everybody else and give everybody else permission to do the same for those parts of themselves. That's exactly why it didn't click for me then. And now it's clicking.
That's so cool. That's so cool. You used a powerful, provocative, and really terrible word earlier, which is shame.
Mm-hmm.
I've read a bunch of John Bradshaw. If you've read him, it's like the ultimate guru on shame and healing the shame that binds you and all this stuff. Like, I've done a lot of shame work. I carried a lot of shame for a long time. I still have some. We all do. But that word, I wonder if you could really drill into that word in your own life and what has releasing it meant for you. And I'll contextualize the question by saying, I actually think that shame is the majority of cases, it's the padlock on people's potential. So when I talk about unlocking your potential in a very real way, I'm talking about overcoming each person's infinitely creative and individuated way that they've allowed shame to fester into their own life. So I'm curious if you could talk about your journey through shame and what that's been for you.
I mean, Brené Brown is my shame kind of guru, and she describes it, you know, guilt is feeling bad for something that you did. Shame is feeling bad for the thing that you are. And I very much internalized my abuse. I was 16. He was much older. And he told me it was my fault. And I carried that for a very long time. And so I internalized that experience. Of course, when I then turned to drugs, to numb and escape and try to navigate this experience that I had no tools or capacity to handle. I took on a lot of shame for that as well. The voice in my head told me that I was a worthless, you know, piece of crap, unlovable, unworthy person because of my behaviors. And when you carry that, yeah, I mean, you show up in life incredibly small. You feel like you are undeserving of any good thing that happens to you. So I had the tendency to self-sabotage because I knew it was going to go terribly in the end and I might as well control how it ends. I didn't let anyone get close to me because I felt like I didn't deserve it. And when they were nice, I was suspicious of what they wanted. And when they weren't nice, it was just what I deserved anyway. I mean, it impacted my entire life and all of my relationships. And it wasn't until I got into therapy after my recovery and started to unpack all of that. And again, I think the key for me has been not to distance myself from those things, not to create a barrier between myself and my abuse or myself and my addiction, but to really wrap all of that up. Like, those are pieces of me. And I am grateful for those pieces of me that navigated these incredibly challenging life circumstances in the best way she knew how. You know, me using drugs literally saved my own life. I didn't know how to navigate this trauma. And instead of taking my life, I chose to use drugs. And I'm so grateful to younger Melissa for like doing the best she could, but embracing all of that and rejecting the idea that I had anything to feel shameful about, I think really was the key that allowed me to then work on aspects of my relationship and my communication and my attachment style and how I felt about work and how I performed in my career and even just my relationship with my own body. So yeah, my work around shame with, again, so much therapy has been incredibly impactful, and I wouldn't be sitting here showing up like I am today without having done that work.
So first of all, I want to thank you, and I want to make sure the audience caught what I'm thanking you for, which is that insight. Thank goodness I used drugs because it saved my life. Because if I hadn't been able to numb, I might have had to do something else to numb the feeling. And I'm sitting here thinking about, it's funny, I have this picture in my mind of sitting in the parking lot at Carl's Jr. having bought $40 worth of food in the drive-thru, sitting in my car and remembering how that felt, the shame of, I mean, like, this was like 10 or maybe 15 years ago, like $40, I mean, I don't know what Carl's Jr. costs now. I'm proud to say I don't know anymore, but I think back to that moment a lot. It wasn't the moment I changed, but it was the moment I realized, like, I've really got an issue here. But this is the first time I've ever looked back on that moment and said, thank goodness, because who knows how I might have been coping if I hadn't been coping that way.
Yeah.
So that's powerful.
It is.
Thanks for that perspective. The other thing is, I'm curious, how much of your journey, I love how you were talking about these things. You like you said, you've wrapped them all together. And it seems like in a very real way, you've transmuted them into fuel, into power, into drive for what you're doing. And so I'm curious, how much of the shame lift, so to speak, do you think is tied now to the fact that not only you've been able to process it and recapture a sense of perhaps control in your life, but also the fact that your life is of great service to others?
It's funny. I really think about it. It's less fuel for my motivation. It's not like, oh, these things happened to me and like I overcame them and I'm going to like really, show the people who look at my old addict self and look what I'm doing now. It's not that at all. It is that in the act of showing myself so much grace and compassion, I have just released so much burden that I am so much more powerful than I ever was, right? It's not fuel. It's not like octane. I'm not doing something in rebellion or in opposition to. It is just that I have chosen to drop the burden. And because of that, I'm so much lighter and I'm so much faster and I'm so much happier. And I think that makes me more powerful. That's how I think about it.
Okay. That is a really important distinction. I appreciate that. And that's good. Yeah. That probably sounds a little healthier. than just saying, oh, I'm using it to push against.
I don't think so. I think that could also be super healthy. I know people who have had really traumatic pasts who say, because of that, I am determined to like turn my life around and do something different. I'm not going to be my father. I'm not going to be my mother. And that has fueled them in a very healthy way. It's just not how, it's not how I think about it. But I mean, the end result is the same. We've taken these pieces of our past, incorporated them into ourselves, and done something different with it.
How much, I guess kind of the last part of that question was, how much do you think that, how much of the shame lift or the, you know, transmutation of pain into purpose or whatever we want to call it is a function of the fact that you're now living in service to so many others? Is that the icing on the cake, or do you think that's an essential part of the formula for overcoming a lot of what you've been through?
Oh, what a good question. I mean, I think it is a natural evolution of the work that I've done, in that I've had this experience for myself, and I want to use that to help other people have the experience. And I do this through a vehicle called the Whole 30. Or that's just one of my vehicles. But I think that, you know, the more we talk about this idea of breadcrumbs and purpose, the more now I can look back and go, no, this was like always how it was going to be, right? That everything that I have been through and the work that I have personally done has led me to this place where I feel like I have so much capacity and so much passion and so much grace that I then have a lot to give to others. And that feels really good. And also continues to feed me. So it does feel like a very natural progression.
Yeah, I think there's a, you know, we talk a lot in marketing about the hero's journey. And we talk about it as sort of a marketing tool, a narrative, you know, created for effect. But I actually love, I think we're somewhat defining that the hero's journey ultimately probably ends where Stephen Covey said, which is the eighth habit, finding your voice and using it to inspire others to find theirs. Anyway, thanks for your time. This has been wonderful. I'm sorry, I wish we had more time. I feel like there's a whole other conversation here, but thanks for being a guest on the show. But more than that, thanks for being an amazing human who's done what you've done and who's doing what you're doing.
Thank you, Jeff. I really enjoyed this conversation. It was very thought-provoking. Yeah.
Well, thanks. I'm going to take that as a compliment.
It is. No, it is a compliment. It really is. Yeah, I feel. Yeah, I enjoyed it.
This was fun. And of course, to all you viewers and listeners out there, you know what I'm about to say. You're the best part of this show. You're why I do what I do every single damn day that I do it. And I'm so glad we got to spend this time together. Cannot wait to see you on the next one. Take care, everyone.
Hey, it's Jeff here. If you liked this episode of Unlock Your Potential, it would mean so much if you would like and share the episode on whatever platform you're listening or viewing on. And if you really like what we're doing here and you enjoy this podcast, please consider leaving a review. There is so much work that goes into these episodes, and you leaving a positive review lets us know that that work is reaching people, and especially it helps us reach other people. Your review could be the reason that someone else decides to tune in, check out this podcast, and unlock their potential and ultimately level up the quality of their life. So thank you so much for your support and for listening, especially if you like or share or leave a review. Thank you for helping us spread the word, and thank you for unlocking your potential to go make the world and your world a better place.